It's hour number two of Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. At 145, where are we at in society? For anyone concerned about homeless camping, the problem here in Austin, who wants to do something about it, you are going to want to listen to this segment today. We are speaking with somebody from Save Austin Now, Matt Makowiak of Save Austin Now, and we need your help right now to try and overturn that. It's just a ridiculous thing for the individuals most affected, those living under highways right now, and also the rest of the city as well. At 1:30, Sark is adding some big-time names to his coaching staff. And in mere minutes, it's my chat with Mike Ayers on his new book, One Last Song. I'm Trey Elling, and sitting across from me is Chad Hastings.
Hour number two. Before the interview, the Texas update real quick. Jeff Banks may very well be coming from the Bama staff, special teams, tight ends coach, though an assistant head coach deal on there, possibly, but it looks like Jeff Banks could be coming with Sarkisian. And don't forget the name Pete Golding, the DC at Alabama, may also be coming to Texas. So keep your eye peeled on that. We'll get you more on that coming up at 1:30. Right now, Trey, let's get into this one last song discussion. I can't wait to hear your decision.
Yes. Mike Ayers has been an arts and entertainment journalist and editor for the Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, GQ, Time, Esquire, Billboard, and many more, and is the author of a book that has spawned our question of the week this week, One Last Song, Conversations on Life, Death, and Music. Mike, thank you so much for the time today. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Trey.
So, Mike, this book is based around a question that I'm going to call a cousin of the age-old question. If you're on death row, what's the last meal you're eating before meeting that fate? And your question is this. If you could listen to one last song on this earth, what would it be? When did you first start pondering this question, and what ultimately inspired you to make a book out of it?
It is a cousin. I started thinking about this question probably about 4 or 5 years ago. I was in New York City. It was a random weekday night. I was seeing a show that I can't remember who at this point. I see a lot of live music. And I just remember sitting on the train coming back to New Jersey. It was 11 o'clock at night. And I threw on a song that has been with me for decades. And I just remember thinking, I never get tired of this song. This song has been with me for so long. And every time I hear it, I hear something new. And I can't imagine not hearing it if it was the last thing I could hear. This would be the perfect thing for me to go out on. And immediately I was like, you know what? That would be a great book if I asked a bunch of musicians that question. And that was it. That was really it. But that being said, that idea sat with me for about 6 months. Mm. And it was probably at that 6 month mark, I was like, you know what? I need to stop thinking of this idea. I need to just send it out into the world. And if somebody responds to it, i.e. a book editor, then I'll know if it's actually a really good idea. And I emailed the woman that I actually worked with on this book. And I sent her just one quick note. I said, hey, what's the last song you'd ever want to hear before you died? And then I hit return a few times to give a dramatic space effect. And then I said, that's the book I want to do. Imagine a bunch of artists asking this question. And she wrote back really quickly and was like, I don't know what this says about me, but I love this idea. Let's talk. And that was almost 4 years ago this spring. And yeah, that's it.
So you talked to more than 30 musicians for this book, and you have some other fun elements that we'll get into in a little bit. What were all the different things that you were having to do to compile this information? Because obviously these musicians are giving you their answers, but are you having to rewrite what they're doing and adding any sort of research to the individual songs that it is that they want to talk about, that they would like to be their last song on planet Earth?
Yeah, interestingly, a lot of times I didn't know what they were going to say before I got them on the phone. So I didn't do a lot of research beforehand. I did research afterwards. I mean, some of the songs, I knew what they were when they said them, but some of them, I wasn't even familiar with them. So I had to do a lot of homework afterwards. You know, it essentially was a lot of emailing and pitching this concept to just a wide range of artists. I think the question is interesting for anybody to answer, regardless of genre, regardless of if you're a musician or you're not. Your answer is inherently interesting to me and tells a story of your life and how you connected to a piece of music and when. And so with the artists, it was really just us having a conversation about this. I kind of had a structure that I worked with every time for the interview where I would ask what their last song was. I would ask if this was a hard assignment. I would ask when they first heard that song. And it was kind of like a good icebreaker. And then we would get into a little bit more of the musicianship behind the song, like why they think this is a great song. And that's when things really started to open up because they were just so familiar with their choice and could articulate in ways that us non-musician folks can in terms of what makes this song so special and just why it works and why it works for a last piece of music for them. And towards the end of our conversations, a lot of times I would delve into themes of death and mortality in their own work and kind of pick at that. And then I would just take the transcript of the audio and work it into an As Told To. And that's how it got presented. There was only one artist that actually wrote his response, and that was Jim James.
Which I guess makes sense because he also wrote the foreword in this book, and we'll get to him in just a little bit. Who was the first artist who actually complied with your request, though, and gave you his or her answer on that one last song?
It was Killer Mike.
Yes.
And yeah, so he got on board immediately. This was June of 2018. And his choice, interestingly enough, was a song that he wrote.
I love that.
And so I got off the phone with him and I was like, part of me was like, that was amazing. That was great. This is going to be a great book. And the other part of me was like, is every artist going to tell me their last song is going to be their own song? Because that is probably not going to work. But it worked out. You know, I didn't edit anybody. And it worked out that just the first was the only time that this happens. But I think his reasoning behind it is so beautiful to me. And it makes complete sense.
The song that he chose of his was Untitled. The name of the song is Untitled for anybody unfamiliar with Killer Mike's work. Why did he choose that song?
He chose it because he thinks that it represented him in the most honest way. He chose it because he looked at his life down the road and hoped that he would be hearing this when he was 70, 80, 90 years old and surrounded by his family. And just that this would be like a small nugget of his life's work to take him into the next life.
So the question is obviously a fascinating one, but I was interested to learn that you slightly altered how you were asking it to these people that you were reaching out to. In what way did you change the question, and how did it alter the way that people were responding or their willingness to respond at all, I guess?
At first, I was very like, this is the rule, and you can't deviate from the rule. You know, if you go with that last meal analogy, you're having a last meal. You're not having breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? But as a few of the interviews went on and I started hearing people think about how this question formulated in their mind, they were asking me questions back that was like, oh, well, when am I dying? Am I dying now? Am I dying in a car wreck, on a ski slope, running into a tree?
Very valid questions, by the way.
So valid. And so everybody started to really think about the context of what the scenario was when they're hearing, because they started to think that, well, I would have a different song for a different scenario. And so when I started to hear some of those things come back at me, I started to loosen up a little. And I guess the ultimate example of me really loosening the question was with the singer-songwriter Will Oldham, who performs under Bonnie Prince Billy. And he was really coming at me in the nicest possible way about the whole scenario aspect of the question. And he essentially said, well, all my best moments of music is not listening to other people's music. I think back to the times when I'm making music with people And that is what I would want to go out with. And he said, so I guess if I knew I had a month left, I would just assemble my friends and we would make a new record together. I just thought that was incredible. That was an incredible way to frame the question around the scenario, but then just, I don't know, make it real personal. I mean, some could say that, okay, maybe he dodged the question a bit, but I don't think he did. It did become such like a personal thing to people when they were explaining their picks. They had really articulate reasons on what this last song would be.
And you got more than 30 musicians to go on the record. Obviously, we've talked about Killer Mike. You just mentioned Will, Courtney Barnett, Andre 3000, Angel Olsen, Jeff Tweedy, Lucinda Williams. Lauren Mayberry, lead singer of Churches, requested Firework by Katy Perry for her last song. Why?
So that was one of my favorite ones, and it was so surprising. That was another one where I didn't know what she was going to say beforehand. And you can kind of see at the beginning of her chapter, the question that I'm asking, like, do you think this was a hard assignment? Because she starts off talking about how when you're in your last moments, do you want something super sad, super profound? Do you want like Johnny Cash singing Hurt? And she essentially worked through it in her mind and out loud that, well, no, she doesn't want anything like that. She wants something that is a bit euphoric and something that reminds her of really good times. And that was Katy Perry's Firework, which is a phenomenal song. And I would think it would work in all sorts of situations and making you feel happy. And she essentially said that this song or Katy Perry's career in a lot of ways is a blueprint for what she wants their band to be doing.
Huh.
Just like these anthemic club songs that people just have euphoria around. And I thought that was a great connection too, that no one other artist really made, that this song would be a reminder of what they were doing, but also a reminder of her good times in her life when she was just coming of age.
Did any musicians decline to answer? And if so, who was the most disappointing refusal?
Well, a lot of people just didn't write me back. And that was challenging. There was like a lot of people that were on my dream list. There's a lot of Britpop stars like Damon from Blur and Noel from Oasis that I just thought would give phenomenal answers. Taylor Swift, like, given a phenomenal answer. I reached out to a lot of hip hop stars as well and just didn't get anywhere with them either. I never felt really disappointed, like, oh man, that was the one that got away. Because the artists that are in here are super profound and it gives a good reader experience working through these. But yeah, if there was a volume two, my mind is just drooling at the possibilities of all the different types of artists that we could tap for this question, because it's just an endless well of answers and insights into musicianship.
Yeah, endless is a good word for it. Now, there are still a ton of awesome voices represented in this book. And as big of a fan as I am of more than half of who you have in here, I'm probably most smitten creatively with Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. Why'd Merrill choose Something by Bach?
Merrill's answer is so beautiful. When I got off the phone with her on that, I had to take a moment and just process her choice. Essentially, she said that her mom was playing this Bach piece when she was in utero, in the womb. And simply put, that would be the circle of life. You know, if she was hearing that at the end of her life, it's a song that she's learned to play and it's a very challenging song. And that's it. That's really it. But that circular feeling of life. And she also made this statement too about how this piece that was written a couple hundred years ago somehow became this piece of music in her life. It found its way to her mother and found its way to her ears in infancy. it just makes complete sense to wrap things up with that as well.
It's really cool to learn about for sure. Now, this book also includes some side chapters that link music and death. Things like the most morbid number one songs of all time, famous musicians and the last live song they played, songs that famous TV characters went out to, and how to pick a song for your own funeral. Now, I am fascinated with morbidity, so this is a chapter that I was not only amused but also enlightened by. So how does one actually pick out a song for his or her own funeral?
This is a common question. People always are talking about their funeral songs. And that's another reason why I thought this book was a great look into music in a person's life, because when you're picking out a funeral song, you're picking out a song that ultimately you're not going to be there. You're not going to hear it. So the last song that you're going to hear is for you. It's a bit selfish, but I think it's worth it. In terms of picking a song out for a funeral, there's a few different ways that I go through it. Some artists over the years had bands play, like Janis Joplin had the Grateful Dead play at her wake and paid for it. Some famous, actually not even some, a lot of famous musicians hire Stevie Wonder to sing at their funeral. Now, for the average person, I would assume that making a killer playlist is paramount. You could go in a few different ways. You could go with the soundtrack of your life, you know, like at these different moments. These are the songs that define my life at different stages. You could just go your favorite songs. You could go ironic songs that will make people laugh in the situation. There's so many ways that you could go and have to think about it. I feel like this is something that people talk about. Oh, I play this song at my funeral. That's my funeral song. But I don't know if people really have that playlist on Spotify saying funeral songs, right? I don't know. I never heard of that.
I think I'm probably just going with the playlist that I have on my phone. And at that point, the funeral is going to have to be like 7 hours long.
Right.
Because you're putting it on shuffle, and otherwise you're only getting a small sliver of that.
Exactly.
Now, you list a bunch of morbid number one songs, as I just mentioned. Is there a most morbid number one song of all time in your mind? And if so, why?
That is a good question. You know, the ones that I talk about in the early years of the Billboard charts, they were weirdly morbid. The Billboard charts started like ranking number ones around in the year of 1958. And there was some things early on that were just, you know, this was like the teenage love years, but there was suicide worked in, there was drowning worked in. The songs that I cite that people probably know are like Mac the Knife and Leader of the Pack and Papa Was a Rolling Stone, and the Rolling Stones' Paint It Black was vaguely about death. And it's just, these are things that somehow crept up to being ubiquitous jams. Is there a all-time, the most morbid song ever? That is a tough question. I feel like, again, if we go back to the context situation, people probably have it for their own life, the things that just make them cry every time they hear it, or at least well up. I don't know. I mean, there's...
I'm going Paint It Black, even though it may not directly address death. I just think that the overall tone of that song, it's just dark, man, and it's spooky, and I've always attributed it to death.
The tone is very dark. It feels like from the beginning, from the first notes, that the end is coming, and that is what they're trying to emote, that the end is near, and they're building to that, and you don't have much time left.
So as we've previously alluded to, Jim James of My Morning Jacket not only supplied a song for this book, but also he wrote you the foreword. How long have you and Jim known one another, and did it take much convincing to get him to write the foreword for you?
So I just reached out to him when I was reaching out to artists to contribute to the book, and he got on board immediately to do his last song, and he was the only one that wrote his chapter, and I got it within 2 days of reaching out to his manager, and I was shocked. And I remember reading it. I got up early that morning, read it kind of bleary-eyed, and it was stunning. It was so stunning. And as I was going through this and getting towards the finish line, I just kept remembering that chapter as being so profound. And so I just reached back out and said, look, I am looking for someone to write a foreword. And I loved this chapter. And I think that you could articulate this book in ways for the beginning. And he got on board immediately. He liked the project. I think like everybody that did participate in this, they liked it. They liked talking about other people's musicianship, what music means to them. And this question is a very high stakes question. It is thought provoking, I think.
And I don't think you mentioned this song at the start of our conversation, but the song that spurred this idea that eventually became the book, One Last Song, is something by the Grateful Dead, Terrapin Station. Is that your one last song now that you've obviously gotten through this project and had a lot of time to think about what that song would be for you?
It is. That was that song that I was thinking about on that night in Hoboken. And I found that song when I was 17, and it has not left me since. Obviously, the Dead played a ton of live shows, so there's a whole bunch of different versions out there to satiate my ears and finding something different. But it's something that if you hear a version that they were performing in the late 70s, it was kind of upbeat. And by the time they were towards the end of their career, Jerry's voice was just so weathered and beat down. And you can hear that in those versions. It's just a song that it has just stuck with me. I hear something new every single time I listen to it. And also, it's really long, so that's nice.
And before I let you go, Mike, can I give you my song?
Please.
Okay, so it's LCD Sound System's New York, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down.
Really?
And the reason why that's my last song is because at this point, although the song is certainly not nearly as old as I am, I want to say it's maybe 15 years old, I have probably sang that song out loud in good times and in bad more than any other song in my life. It evokes just a variety of memories, again, good and bad, helping me get through the bad times and helping me to truly embrace the good. And it's to the point now, this my love and fascination with this song, that I have a 6 and a 4-year-old. And sometimes when we're driving from point A to point B, my kids and my wife and I will all be in the car and we're all singing it together. And they don't quite know all the words yet. And I emphasize yet, because they will eventually know all of these words. It's just like a family bonding moment at this point, despite the fact that James Murphy is singing about how badly the island is bumming him out in that moment.
When did you first hear that?
The first time I heard that song, okay, so this speaks to the bad perhaps, but it would have been when I was living in Chicago, and it was just a rough point in the winter. A girl might have just dumped me. The city was just doing what big cities do to people sometimes, just kind of chewing you up and trying really hard to spit you out. And hearing that song and that album, the whole album speaks to me, but that song especially, which ends the entire album, was one that ended up on repeat one over and over again for, I want to say, like at least a couple of weeks, if not a month.
You know, what's interesting about that choice is, and a theme that I noticed throughout this book, through these folks' answers, is that a lot of the music that they picked was very coming of age music, meaning that they discovered this in their teens or early 20s. And those are the moments that really stuck with them. But this was not the case for you.
So it's interesting that you say that, Mike, because although I would have been in my, I think technically my early 30s at the time, I moved to Chicago at 31, and I think it would have been within that first year, it was that point in time where I felt like I was actually growing up. So we all obviously go through epiphanies where we feel more adult from one day to the next. For some people, that does happen when they're teenagers, in their early 20s, mid-20s. Some people, it may not happen until their 60s or 70s, sadly. For me, it was early 30s. So yes, that was a growing up moment for me.
I think like this art form, music, is something that is unlike no others in terms of connecting to people in those moments of change. You could probably cite like a book that was meaningful or a film or any sort of work of art, but music, I think, connects to people in those moments in ways that is so unique. And what you're describing, that even though it wasn't like you're 15 or 22, but early 30s, it still had that same pull over you that is, you know, when it washes over you and you can't let go, it's a great feeling. It's a great feeling when you have something that someone's made that you can listen to 1,000 times and just still love. I mean, you're not going to watch a movie 1,000 times. You're not going to watch a TV show 1,000 times, but the fact that you can listen to a song that many times and not tire of it, it's amazing.
And there it is, my conversation with Mike Ayers, author of One Last Song, Conversations on Life, Death, and Music. I apologize for the technical glitch there. If you'd like to hear the entire conversation, if you maybe jumped in on the middle, you can do so at booksonpod.com or by searching Books on Pod with Trey Elling, wherever you listen to podcasts. Chad?
Well, damn it, Trey. I thought I had it. I don't know you at all. I was certain it was going to be Humpty Dance by Digital Underground. Damn
close.
It. Damn it. So close. There
That's
you go.
Up.
Trey, by the way, somebody on the text line, please type it back to them. They're asking you to tell them the full name of that song. Of course, your song choice has like 9,000 words. Like, that's going to take extra time, too. That'll help you stay alive a little bit longer while maybe someone has to say, oh, we're playing this song. And what's it called? Well, it's like 15 words.
The song is a little bit longer. It's also a crescendo, too, which I didn't mention during that conversation. But I like the idea of something starting slow and ending on a high note.
That is fantastic. So that's Trey's choice for the one last song before he leaves Earth. The people are asking about the book. It's called One Last Song. Mike Ayers is the author. A lot of people dug that. As always, Trey does an incredible job on the interviews. Great job by Mike to come up with that idea. As we go through the show, the music you'll hear are Trey's honorable mentions. He's already given you a few of those. More of that coming up. Plus, back to the Longhorn stuff. Basketball loses their first conference game, and Coach Sarkisian continues to build a staff. It could be as many as 3 guys off the main staff and an analyst from the Bama crew. We'll give you the names coming up on the Horn. Trey's giving you his honorable mentions for One Last Song. We just found out what Trey's one last song would be. Trey, what is this one?
This is Gary Clark Jr., Please Come Home. And this is not just about my love for this song, which I believe won Gary his very first Grammy.
Huh.
It's just fond memories I have from getting to see him perform and listen to him perform over time. Obviously, he's got 3 full studio albums now. He's won a ton of awards. He is just a big-time rock star. But yeah, this Gary speaks to me from multiple points of my life. Again, good and bad. And although I don't think I can actually sing all of these lyrics word for word, I know enough of them, and the song is the right sort of tone that I think would be a nice way to go out.
He's such a beast. When he sings like this, to me, his voice doesn't match his body. Like, it doesn't look like that man should sing like this. But then again, this is a very, like, angelic, you know, male falsetto that nobody should be able to hit. But when he goes here, man, it's awesome.
I understand that his falsetto is not as good as his guitar playing, because he literally may be the best guitar player on the planet right now. but for me, it's close. That's how much I love his falsetto.
It's great stuff, man. I love how he ties everything together.
Channeling his inner Stevie.
I would not have been surprised if your one last song had been Gary Clark Jr.
What was your guess, by the way?
Real guess,
or did you have a guess?
Honestly, for you, I never made an official guess in my head. I well admit that your... We always talk about music snobbery. Your music snobbery runs deeper than mine does. And there's no way, like, I haven't been around you enough when you're listening to music. We haven't been to enough concerts together. I just don't have enough of a connect. Gary Clark Jr. would be my own, would have been my guess. I would have just said him as an artist.
Yeah.
Not a song. I would have just guessed Gary Clark Jr. But outside of that, I didn't have anything specific.
And that pick was reflective of just how much I admire him as a musician.
Oh, he's beastly. Yeah, he is so, so good. I could pick just about anything I've heard by Gary Clark Jr. If you just told me, like, hey, your last song has to be Gary Clark Jr., all right, sure, just pick one. Just pick a song. I'm fine.
Pretty much.
I'd go with Travis County. But that's just a general discussion. All right, so we'll have more of those songs coming up. Also, we remind you, if you need something else to listen to, how about a couple of interviews with the coaches going for state championships this weekend? Remember, Saturday at 7 is the Dodge Bowl with Westlake and Southlake Carroll, and Coach Dodge, the dad, joined Craig and Jeff this week. You can check that out at hornfm.com. Cedar Park goes for their title tomorrow night, Friday night at 7. And the interview with Coach Abseck is also at hornfm.com. Get the Horn app. Make sure you can take us with you around the country and around the world. A lot of folks do that, or just around town. All right, let's get back into some Texas stuff. We'll go football first. Texas and Steve Sarkisian trying to build that staff. Big news today, Trey, is it looks like Jeff Banks is coming too. That is being reported by a couple of the insider sites, and even the national folks are willing to throw Jeff Banks' name out. Assistant head coach, special teams, and tight ends. He will be coming to Texas. So looks like Kyle Flood for OC and O-line. That's off the Bama staff. Jeff Banks would be off the Bama staff officially. If Pete Golding comes, the DC, that would be three coaches off the actual staff. And then there's still the discussion that A.J. Milwee, the analyst at Bama, will be coming as the quarterback's coach. So you're talking four total, three off the main staff right now. Seems possibly realistic for, you know, coming from Bama to Texas.
That's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like one of the things that started the last two coaches off on the wrong foot is them insisting on bringing in too many of their guys from their previous coaching staff. And on the one hand, you understand that. Those guys helped to get you to this point. But I think with a job like Texas, you have to understand that with the open checkbook and just the magnitude of this job, you need to make sure that you're on point with every single one of those hires. And you and I talked about this at the start of the show, and I don't want to steal your point necessarily, but it might work in Sarkisian's advantage that he is coming from the OC ranks to take this job to where he doesn't feel more obligated and he can put together a sort of dream team coaching staff.
Well, like somebody just texted me a while ago, well, wait a minute, he's bringing his buddies. Isn't that what got Tom Herman in trouble? And I texted back, different class of buddies, first off.
Yeah.
But also, he's disconnected enough that he wasn't a head coach with a full staff in place. And also, and I'm not trying to dog the situation, but it's realistic to say what I'm about to say. He didn't come from Houston.
Right.
I mean,
and he didn't come from Louisville.
He didn't come from Louisville. He didn't come from Houston. It's just a different discussion. So, it's a different class of buddies, if you will. We're talking about a group that was together at Alabama thrashing folks for the last 2 years, including a dominant national title run this year. So that's the part that would definitely stand out to me if I am a Texas fan. And I'll get into this a little bit tomorrow in the crap bag, but I was, you know, recrunching some numbers last night. Trey, you were saying earlier about, you know, everyone should thank Texas for breaking up that Bama staff. I mean, I'm sitting here as an Aggie fan.
Yeah.
And my first two thoughts are, A, I should be thanking CDC for thinking of something I didn't think of. But also, I'm not saying it's going to be easy to deal with Bama, but Bill O'Brien calling that offense, it can't get more dynamic, can it?
No.
For people like me, for people like, you know, Arkansas fans that we have listening to the show, Auburn fans, LSU fans, we're all having to deal with them every single year. So getting Steve Sarkisian out of Tuscaloosa might not be the worst news in the world if you're a fan of a team in the SEC West, SEC East, if you're a fan of Clemson, if you're a fan of Ohio State. This may not be bad news.
I mean, they just set some sort of ranking for the entirety of a recruiting class, for this most recent class that I guess technically finishes up here next month. So Bama is still going to be Alabama, but you're absolutely right. Sarkisian is at the forefront of offensive innovation. And it shouldn't be too big of a step down for Bill O'Brien. He obviously made a name for himself as a play caller before he ultimately took the Penn State gig and helped them to pull out of what they were going through with the Joe Paterno, Jerry Sandusky scandal. But at the same time, I think it is valid to question whether he still has those chops because he was the play caller for Houston at times during his tenure. It was part of the bailout for him is that he would fire his OC and say, well, I'm going to go back to calling plays. I think that happened two different times. Neither time it worked out.
Yep. All right, you want to hit the break here? Throw in a little basketball.
Throw in some quick basketball.
All right, Texas loses last night to Tech. Trey McClung hit the last-second shot, kind of pulled the Andrew Jones in reverse. Give me a quick takeaway as a fan from the first conference loss.
The second half was a little bit troubling because it saw the resurfacing of some bad habits that this Longhorn basketball team has been guilty of during the Shaka Smart era, and that's building up a lead and then losing focus on what you need to be doing, especially on the offensive end of the floor. It got really sloppy on the offensive end. They were terrible from two-point range, and part of that was they weren't making the effort to move the ball around and move around as individuals and keep good enough spacing on the floor to set themselves up for easy shots. They were settling for just some really bad threes near the end of that game, and I was not at all a fan of the play that was quote-unquote drawn up at the end there after Texas Tech hits the big, what turned into a long two. With 3 seconds left, you need to get the ball from the inbounds pass to half court, if nothing else. If not a little bit beyond half court, and have something drawn up, have some screen set up to get somebody an open look, either from three, or maybe have somebody cutting to the basket where you can fling a quick pass down low to provide an easy opportunity to win that ball game. They basically just allowed Matt Coleman to come get it, dribbled up the floor, and take a runner from Dame Lillard territory as the buzzer sounded. That's not a good shot. You had enough time to do something better with that.
All right, Trey, before the break, would you agree with me that this stat doesn't need to be true? Texas Tech had more points off turnovers than Texas had points in the paint.
That's not good, nor is what you pointed out to me before the show, that the points off of turnovers was what, 19-0?
19-0, yeah.
That is shocking. And honestly, it's surprising that Texas was in the game with such a statistic.
Well, that's the thing. I was sitting there thinking, wait a second, I don't want to go look it up, but has anybody ever won a major college basketball game as a top five team with no points off turnovers? None? And you go minus, it was minus 17, I think, up to the last part of the game, and then it ends up 19-0. Just crazy stats there. And also, I think it was, what, 13 missed free throws? We talked about this team hitting big free throws. That was huge last night. If they kind of shoot, if they shot what they'd been shooting, they win the ball game. That front end, the 1-1 for Brown was big. They missed huge free throws.
Yeah, and part of that was Jericho Sims. He's just not good from the line. He was below 50% last night, too. So you take that with Jericho because he provides you so much else down low. But that's maybe a little bit of a blueprint for teams that are trying to come back in games. If Jericho Sims is in there, when he gets the ball, just foul him, especially when it's a 1-1 opportunity. That might be as good as a turnover for you or a missed shot.
Yeah, more Texas stuff coming up at 2 o'clock. Remember, Texas hoops in Kansas State Saturday at 7. And that is the next game.
And ultimately, though, Chad, just have a short memory. Understand that you need to stay focused in the second half of a game, that you're going into the locker room at halftime with a 10-point lead, and don't allow such a collapse to happen, because it was bewildering to watch things go down. Because even though Texas, you know, they obviously coughed up the lead, it didn't feel like Texas Tech was earning it as much as it was Texas blowing it.
Texas Tech goes to 11-3, 4-2 in conference with the win. Texas falls to 4-1 in conference. They are 10-2 overall. All right, coming up, where are we at in society? Trey's got an interview coming. If you are focused on the homeless camping issue in Austin, Trey's about to talk to somebody from Save Austin Now to tell you something that you can do about it. Don't move. This is The Horn. I mean all disrespect.
in the neighborhood bars I'd once dreamt I would dream.
We're getting you some of Trey's honorable mentions as we come back into the segments today.
This is actually the song.
Oh, this is the song?
Yeah.
Oh, this is the one.
Yeah, I panicked. I forgot to have another honorable mention loaded up, so I just went with New York, I Love You.
So this is Trey's song, LCD Sound System, New York, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down.
Yep.
Is the full official title?
Yep.
All right, that's Trey's song. One last song he would want to hear before leaving this planet.
And hearing a snippet of a song like that doesn't do it justice. Listen to the whole thing. It's a crescendo.
Also, tomorrow we'll do some of my honorable mentions throughout, and Trey wants to hear my song at 2 o'clock, or my decision on my song. I'm still deliberating, but I think I may have it. 2 o'clock tomorrow, we'll do that. Right now, though, let's go Where Are We At in Society.
Where are we at in society today?
All right, today's Where Are We At in Society is going to involve a conversation with friend of the station, Matt Makowiak of Save Austin Now. You may remember them from back in the summer. They tried to get a measure on the ballot that essentially overturned the city allowing homeless camping any and everywhere. It is something that is not fair to the individuals who are living under highway overpasses or lining Lady Bird Lake, nor is it fair to the rest of the city either. And we're up on another important deadline right now that I wanted to help Matt spread the word on. First off, Matt, thank you for the time. How are you doing today, man?
Hey, guys, I'm doing great. It's awesome to be with you. I've been listening for all these years, and it's really cool to be on. So thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So what's the deadline coming up on Monday, Matt, and where are we in terms of trying to reach a certain goal by that deadline?
Yeah, so the city says you have to have 20,000 signed petitions certified to put a petition on the ballot, put an ordinance on the ballot. And as you said, we tried this last year. We turned in 24,500 petitions on July 20th. They came back about 3 weeks later on August 5th and said we were 900 short. We don't believe we were 900 short. We analyzed what they did. We've sued the city. But that's going to take 2 or 3 years to get resolved. So we took the difficult decision to start from zero and make a second effort, which we launched around December 1st. So last time we had 148 days. We're doing this in 60 days through the holidays, through COVID and everything. But because of the extraordinary efforts of so many people around the city, we have 200 to 250 volunteers, 2,200 donors, 27,000 email addresses now. We are up to 24,500 signed petitions in hand. We're trying to get all the way to 30,000 so that there is absolutely no chance the city can screw us again as they did once before. So we've got 5 days left. We are going to wrap this up on Monday. And so for anyone out there that is a registered voter in the city of Austin, you have to live in the city of Austin. If you live in Bee Caves or Leander or something else, unfortunately you can't sign. But if you do live in the city of Austin and you agree with us that we need to reinstate the camping ban, not because we hate homeless people, but because we hate camping, which is a behavior that produces human waste and physical waste and is bad for public safety and bad for public health and bad for tourism. If you want to see that reinstated, we need you to take action. You can go to SaveAustinNow.com. You can download the petition. It's too late to mail it in, but you'll see on the website there are locations where you can drop it off over the next 5 days all over the city. And if you have questions or concerns, you can email me right now, Matt@SaveAustinNow.com.
So you have to be a resident of the city of Austin, and this is not a Travis County thing. This is a city of Austin thing. And Matt, I was driving around downtown with my wife the other night. We were celebrating our anniversary, and I knew it was happening downtown under I-35, but it was still shocking to see the degree with which people are camping out down there. This city has promised and essentially said when they implemented this that the homelessness issue in Austin needed to be brought out from behind the Greenbelt, let's say. And anybody who has lived in Austin for any period of time understands there is a homelessness issue there. So that on its surface was absurd. But did I read correctly within the last month or so that the city just decided not to spend something like $41 million of the $71 million they had earmarked for homeless issues for fiscal 2020?
That's exactly right. And I give Ryan Autulo, the former, I think, UT baseball's beat writer at the Statesville, but who's now covering City Hall, a lot of credit for performing, accountability journalism just about a month ago. He did go into the details and looked at the budget and studied it and found that the city had $71 million to spend in fiscal year 2020, which ended September 30th, and that by the end of the fiscal year they left something like 43% of that money on the table. Now, they're saying, oh, we can still spend some of it, and there's some ways around it. But at the end of the day, remember, when this ordinance passed in June of 2019 and took effect July 1st, and chaos ensued almost immediately. The council came back and they said, look, we have to double spending on homelessness. It's a huge problem. We want to move towards housing. They went from $30 million to $60 million in 2018 to 2019. And, you know, the belief was they were going to start buying these motels and converting them into transitional housing. And look, our organization supports housing for the homeless. They need to be in safe places. They need to be getting drug and alcohol abuse treatment and mental health treatment. They don't need to be on the side of the road or living under the 7th Street Bridge or on the median on Riverside Drive. But the city has absolutely, manifestly, unquestionably failed to ramp up housing in the last year and a half. And so that story in the Statesman showed that not only did they have $60 million to spend in 2019 and they did almost nothing useful with it, they had $71 million to spend in 2020 and they left nearly half of it on the table because of their own failures and inefficiencies and just ridiculousness. So, you know, the issue for us is we feel like they believe tents are homes. They believe that they don't have a sense of urgency on housing the homeless because from their perspective, they believe a tent is a home. Look, a tent wasn't a home last night when the wind chill was 30 or 32 degrees. It's not a home when it's 110 degrees on the sidewalk in July and August. A tent is a temporary structure. Camping takes a public space, converts it to a private use, and it has all kinds of negative consequences that come with it. You know, for some of your listeners out there who may agree with us, but they may also be wondering, well, what happens to all the homeless people? And I get that question a lot, and it's really important that people understand this. Number one, we want them back in the homeless shelters. A homeless shelter is a far better place for a homeless person to be than camping on the side of the road, right? Homeless shelters generally don't allow drugs and alcohol. They don't allow strangers. They don't allow drug dealers. You have a roof over your head. You're getting treatment. You're getting meals. You're getting medical help. So that's number one. But we don't have enough homeless shelters. But we need to get homeless people back into the homeless shelters because they emptied after the camping ordinance took effect. Number two, they need to be in transitional housing. The city has opened one or two of these facilities. They've bought more than that. They're converting them far too slowly. They're overpaying for them. But obviously, we want to put them in transitional housing. But Trey, here's the third point that is so crucial. Because if those first two spaces are full, then the question is what happens to everyone else, people who are camping now? Well, there's a good answer. The state opened a campground in September of 2019. It's called Camp Abbott, or sometimes called Camp Rad. It's down on Research Boulevard, kind of towards the airport. It's self-enclosed. It has police on site 24/7. It has 11 different services, including toilets and showers and electricity. Anyone who's camping now can camp there if they can't find homeless shelters and they can't find transitional housing. So this is a problem we can solve, and we can put the urgency back on the city to actually deliver on housing for the homeless, and we don't need to go through this disaster we've gone through for the last year and a half.
I had not heard about Camp Abbott. Mm-hmm. That is another thing that is a game changer, and even for anybody that was okay with the city doing this the first time around, the fact that they have basically dragged their feet and not made any effort to help fix the problem should be a big enough red flag for you to want to sign this petition to then put this in the hands of the people so that they can overturn this, Matt, because I know Republicans and Democrats in this town who normally don't see eye to eye on anything, they agree that what this city did, what Abbott and his cronies did a year and a half ago has been a huge negative for the city,
yeah,
and it's
Adler.
Something that needs
yeah,
to
Adler.
Change.
Adler, excuse me.
Yes, I said Abbott.
Yeah,
Adler.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And look, I don't actually judge the intentions of people. I think that's a dangerous place to get to. From Adler's standpoint, he thought, look, all we're doing is moving these people around. It takes a lot of time. It doesn't really get us anywhere. Look, the police were getting 95% compliance with the camping ordinance, with the camping ban, excuse me, before the camping ordinance took effect. So this idea that Homes Not Handcuffs and Greg Kassar have been pushing, that the police were rounding up homeless people and criminalizing homeless existence, is just not true. In 5% of cases where someone refused to stop camping because it was illegal, you have to be able to put someone like that in prison if they won't comply with the law. Otherwise, we're not going to have laws. We're not going to have a law. We're going to have a lawless, society. So this idea that this was a widespread problem is just simply not true. But if you look at it now, the bigger problem is our homeless population in Austin is exploding. You know it. I know it. We see it. It's in every neighborhood. It's at every intersection of two major roads. But I'll give you a data point. So the nonprofit ECHO, which runs the Arch Downtown Ending Community Homeless Organization, does an amazing effort every January. They do something called the Point in Time Study. They go out and recruit hundreds and hundreds of volunteers, and they count every homeless person on one night. So last year when they did this, January, they took them 4 months to finish the report. It usually takes them 2 months, which told you that the numbers were going to be bad. The unhoused homeless population grew in 2019, the calendar year, by 46%. And that's with the camping ordinance only being in effect for half the year. Just last week they announced they're not doing the point-in-time study this year. Now they're blaming COVID, even though we just read in the Statesman that 13% of homeless people have been vaccinated. They're not doing the point-in-time study this year, and I don't think it has anything to do with COVID. It's because they know the homeless population is exploding, and they don't want to give any more momentum to what we're trying to do, which is to reinstate the camping ban, go back to where we were last June, restore the sit-lie ordinance to downtown, and then extend it to the UT campus and to an area that's 2.5 miles in all directions to capture most of the residence areas. And then third, to ban panhandling at night, 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. citywide. It's a visibility issue, and it's a safety issue. If you agree with us that that would be a better place for our city to be, where we would be safer, where tourism would be better, where our businesses would be protected, and in fact where the homeless would be in homeless shelters and in transitional housing, and if need be camping at the state campground rather than all over the city, if you believe that, then we need you to go to Save Austin Now right now. SaveAustinNow.com. Go to the site, download the petition, and go drop it off at some point over the next 3 days. All the locations are on the website. You can donate. You can sign up to volunteer. We need your help. Everyone out there listening, if you are tired of what this city council has done to this city for the last year and a half, we need you to take action over the next few days.
You have to be a City of Austin resident, but you can start that process of filling out the petition at SaveAustinNow.com. He is Matt Makowiak, one of the co-founders of Save Austin Now, and a guy who is trying to get a pretty rotten policy changed for this great city. Matt, thank you as always for the time, man. It was good catching up with you, and best of luck getting to that figure by Monday.
Thanks, guys. Love what you do. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Take care.
Good stuff there. And again, SaveAustinNow.com to get access to that petition. Man's making some sense there. It would appear. Go check that out. SaveAustinNow.com. Some good stuff there. Thanks to Matt for his time. Thanks to that group for doing what they are doing. Coming up, we'll get your 2 o'clock hour started with some Texas updates. The coaching staff of Steve Sarkisian, who could be on it, who's coming from Bama. What about the other jobs that need to be filled? And the basketball team loses the first conference game. We'll jump into that. At 2:30, why January the 14th matters today, including a national day that Trey and I do not agree with. We do not believe in it, and we never will. We'll tell you what it is on the horn.